just wish there was something going on in higher education journalists like me could report on or talk about. Hi, and welcome to The Key, Inside Higher Ed's News and Analysis Podcast. I'm Doug Letterman, editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed and your host. Thanks for hanging out with us a bit today. In this episode, you'll eavesdrop on a conversation about some of the hottest news developments unfolding in higher education today. Joining me for the discussion is Catherine Knott, who covers federal policy for Inside Higher Ed, and Aaron Hennessy, Executive Vice President
at TVP Communications, and one of the biggest higher ed news junkies I know.
We'll explore a range of topics, including how the recent formation of a union for basketball players at Dartmouth College might help to reshape college sports, the turmoil created by the federal government's botched rollout of the federal financial aid form, FAFSA, or as I call it, the F word, and what Inside Higher Ed's recent survey of college and university presidents says about higher education and about campus leaders themselves. Before we begin today's conversation, here's a word from CourseDog, which is sponsoring this series of episodes of The Key.
This episode of The Key is brought to you by CourseDog. Academic operations encompasses the work that goes into delivering a great educational experience to your students. Assessment, curriculum and catalog management, and course and event scheduling all underpin student success. Do it all in CourseDog's academic operations platform, which integrates with your SIS. Empower your team with CourseDog. Visit CourseDog.com/IHE to learn more. CourseDog, higher ed's best friend.
Now on to today's conversation with Catherine Knott and Aaron Hennessy.
Aaron and Catherine, welcome to The Key. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Doug.
Yeah, so happy to be here.
One of the major developments of the last week was the Dartmouth College men's basketball team voting to unionize a few weeks after a regional office of the National Labor Relations Board declared the players to be employees. The vote represents another potentially major step in the erosion of the concept of amateurism in big-time college athletics. And while we've seen advocates for athletes cheer the ruling, there's a lot of opposition to it also. Catherine, the House Education Committee held a hearing this morning on the topic, and you were listening in. How does Congress seem to be approaching this issue?
So today, the hearing was focused primarily on student-athlete unionization. It's the first time Congress has really focused on this issue particularly. We've had a lot of hearings, I think 11 is the last count, on name and image likeness rights. And the question of are student athletes employees and, you know, should they be able to collectively bargain has been a theme in those. But this is the first time Congress has taken the issue head on. So far, I'd say Republicans are on the committee are not interested in the idea of students athletes unionizing, and they're worried what it means for Olympic sports. They want to protect the idea of the student in the student athlete and the idea of academic excellence and non-revenue sports and all of that, where Democrats on the committee are pretty united in that students should be able to collectively bargain and should unionize if they wish. They've been pressing the witnesses about how a union could address injury protection so that if students do get injured, they can be compensated for that or at least get treatment, how it can help them pay for things like basic needs. The Democrats have really been harping on how many student athletes are considered food insecure. And yeah, so it's been interesting so far.
When we were looking at the composition of the hearing ahead of time, it seemed to be pretty stacked toward people who would be skeptical of unionization. Is that largely how it played out?
Yeah. So when Republicans control the committee, so they get to call three of the four witnesses, and then the Democrats get to call one witness. So the Democrats' witness was the NLRB chair for 7 years, who actually oversaw the decision, I think in 2015, to say that the Northwestern football players couldn't unionize. So he had to kind of answer, if you said no then, why are you now supporting the Dartmouth players from unionizing? He's not on the NLRB board now. But the other witnesses, I think we had one who was a lawyer kind of on the employment law side, another was a sports lawyer. So they were talking about the potential consequences of student athletes unionizing and where's the money going to come from and how we could see colleges closing down non-revenue generating programs. And the other witness is the athletic director at St. Joseph's University. And so a small college with 480 athletes. And she was pretty clear that she, you know, supports the idea of unions broadly, but does not support the idea of student athletes unionizing, mainly because she was just like, there's no money at St. Joe's to give. And she thinks there are bigger issues in college sports that need more systemic solutions than one union at one sport at one university.
Yeah, I just, it's such a great opportunity to sit and chat with reporters and to find out what you know. So I wanted to ask Catherine, was there any connection made to sort of the larger trend of unionization among students at colleges and universities broadly, not necessarily the athletes, but the cafeteria workers, the RAs, the graduate students? Was there any connection there?
Yeah, actually, great question, because one of the representatives brought up how a lot of the arguments that people are making at the hearing against student athletes unionizing were made when the grad students were unionizing at Columbia. A lot of the same arguments were made, and he was saying the sky hasn't fallen on universities yet. So if kind of drawing that parallel of like grad students have been able to unionize, we've seen them choose it. Not all grad students are unionizing either. So not to say that all students will unionize if they're athletes too.
The unionization issue is just one of the many that are roiling big time college sports right now. Catherine, you mentioned all the hearings there have been on the name, image, and likeness issue, and that has really turned the entire college sports world upside down, creating major differences from college to college because of the differing state laws and enormous differences in the wealth of the programs and the people who support them, the boosters and others. Was there recognition in the congressional conversation about the desire for national or systemic approaches to this and to avoid the competitive imbalance and confusion that having different rules for different teams in different parts of the country might have?
I mean, it came up in a lot of different ways. I have lost track of how many times we heard one size fits all doesn't work. In the case of student athlete unions, that only applies to private sector colleges. So that came up a lot in terms of competitive imbalance, like in a place like Northwestern in the Big Ten, since that was an example that came up at the hearing, you know, they were the only private college at the time in the Big Ten. So what would that mean? And so there's a lot of concern. I mean, there's also concerns about how if you're considered an employee from the National Labor Relations Act, are you then an employee under fair labor standards? Are you then an employee under state workers' comp? So like a lot of questions about like that confusion and uncertainty. But in terms of like the colleges, I think there was a lot of, in like the types of colleges and types of programs, there was a lot of raising the specter of like the poor small colleges that you know, are like D2, D3, that don't have the resources to pay for a union as compared to the large Power 5 conferences that are making a lot of money, and kind of what is that balance? So I think a lot of questions and a lot of concerns, but I feel like in these NIL debates, everyone will point to the highly paid colleges and they will point to like this, the big figure NIL deals, but there's so much more in athletics that's going on than just that. But
Dartmouth is challenging the NLRB ruling, just as Northwestern did a decade ago. And the National NLRB office, assuming it affirms the regional ruling, is going to have to embed some nuance and distinction in what it says and does, or that will have to be adjudicated in the courts afterwards, because there are major differences between athletes in football and basketball, and in some other sports in Division I, and of course, between athletes in the various NCAA competitive levels. A Division III swimmer and a quarterback competing in the college football playoff don't have a ton in common. I don't know what it would have looked like if an Amherst basketball team, say, had tried to unionize. Dartmouth is in some ways closer to Amherst, which is in Division III, than it is to Kentucky in terms of basketball, because Dartmouth and the Ivy League doesn't offer scholarships, et cetera. But Dartmouth does play at the highest level of big-time college sports. So it will be fascinating to see what lines are drawn. Is it certain sports? Is it only at certain levels? The NLRB decision was as much about how much control the college had over the players' time and other things. There are plenty of sports that are not football and basketball where the college and the program have a ton of control over how the players spend their time. At the highest level, it's really less about how a university would negotiate pay with a particular union. If those athletes are employees, so much of the college athletics model falls apart. You've got workman's compensation and all sorts of other things that would have to be dealt with. The other complication, as you said, Catherine, is that the NLRB's rulings only apply to private universities, which are not the majority of big-time football and basketball programs. So there's just tons of confusion that this is likely to create. and it'll be a while before that gets sorted out.
Yeah, I was in the Philadelphia airport on Sunday night preparing to travel to Seattle for the NASPA conference, and I was absolutely surrounded by college and university athletes. Everybody had the matching backpacks and the travel sweats. And looking at that, my first thought is always, I'm thinking about the classes that you're missing and the work you need to be doing on the road. But my second thought was, if this moves beyond Dartmouth and is upheld and moves beyond Dartmouth, what does this start to do when you think about overtime and when you think about travel conditions and when you think about we're going to negotiate that we can only travel this many days during the academic, all of these questions. What does this do to recruitment when the coaches are sitting in some high school kid's living room saying, hey, this is what I can promise you, and one union is driven a harder bargain? It opens up so many beyond sort of the big higher ed issues. It opens up so many logistical day-to-day questions about how these students will continue to experience a degree, what happens with transfers and the portal. I mean, just there are so many more questions than there are answers right now. And on some level, I'm glad that it's a Dartmouth that is going to be sort of the canary in the coal mine on this and sort of go first and ask a lot of these questions and help us all find answers. But I'm with you, Doug. After so many years of watching college athletics, I feel like this has been a reckoning in terms of a lot of us starting to just be more honest about what big time college athletics is. And it's long overdue. But I feel like we're in this brave new world where we're just stumbling through the dark, trying to find a light switch and see what's actually going on.
I feel like the unions are a brave new world too, but like NIL has already disrupted so much of like what has been like a really cohesive model that had, you know, just the NCAA rules, and they applied throughout everything else. And I mean, I've heard time and time again that the student athlete being an employer, like being an employee question, is the NCAA's top priority. Like, they're currently trying to get a lot of things through Congress. They want student athletes to be exempt from being called employees. Like, that is the thing, because of all the things you're saying, like, it would, like, that reclassification would just change so much of the underlying model. And, but at the same point, which I thought it came up at the hearing today, like, collective bargaining one sport at a time is also the way to kind of address how every sport is different and every institution is different, because, like, what the Dartmouth players need are going to be different from what the USC players who are currently trying to unionize need, and the resources at the colleges, so you can kind of like work that out. Where, like, if a Supreme Court rules one day that, like, they are now all employees, that's going to happen across the system. And
you really do need systemic solutions to something like this, because it's, I mean, I think the technical term is a shit show if you have just a free-for-all. That's very much what we're having with the NIL stuff right now. And I don't think that's workable, but it is interesting. The NCAA is looking to Congress to help it. And maybe there are enough members of Congress who are sports fans and will want to sustain things. But I don't think most of the national solutions that we might see coming out of Congress or an administration, say, are going to be friendly to the NCAA. They're looking for an antitrust exemption in a major way, for instance, that would let the association keep doing a lot of what it has historically done. And I just don't see that as likely to come. Part of me would like to see the edifice kind of crumble and see what gets rebuilt in its place. I kind of think that's where we might be headed, but it's not going to be pretty along the way.
Yeah, well, it's you know, yet another example of the NCAA, you know, showing up a little bit too late and trying to still engineer an outcome. When did Knight Commission talk about NIL, you know, make recommendations on NIL? 10 years ago? 12 years ago? I'm with you, Doug. The current system doesn't work. The current, you know, approach that NCAA has, which is, you know, sort of been to hide its head in the sand on these big major things that are shaping its entire approach to business. I don't know that a rebuilt thing is going to be better, but I don't think it could be worse.
This episode of The Key is brought to you by CourseDog. Academic operations encompasses the work that goes into delivering a great educational experience to your students. Assessment, curriculum and catalog management, and course and event scheduling all underpin student success. Do it all in CourseDog's academic operations platform, which integrates with your SIS. Empower your team with CourseDog. Visit CourseDog.com/IHE to learn more. CourseDog, higher ed's best friend.
You're listening to The Key, Inside Higher Ed's News and Analysis podcast. We're talking today with Catherine Knott, who covers federal policy for Inside Higher Ed, and Aaron Hennessy, Executive Vice President at TVP Communications. So moving on from athletics to student aid, and specifically the Federal Student Aid Forum, the FAFSA.
Catherine, you and Liam Knox, your good colleague at Inside Higher Ed, published a major opus last week, I guess it was, trying to assess and analyze kind of this FAFSA fiasco that we've seen unfold over recent months. And I wondered if you could give us a quick summary of kind of what you found, why you decided to dig into it in the way you did.
So I've been on the FAFSA since I got here, but we hadn't really taken a step back in the last few months of assessing how did we end up here where we are at the end of February, as that's when the story was published. And the colleges still don't have the FAFSA forms. Say, you know, which means the department is starting to process them this week, which means colleges will finally are supposed to start getting the actual student records so they can create the aid packages that allow students to know how much money they have for college. So this is the way we kind of approach that question, is looking at the timeline and giving people a sense of why the FAFSA is changing this year and what are the different theories and ideas out there for how a project that was passed with, you know, by Congress with bipartisan support has just gone so far off the rails. So we heard a bunch of ideas. I think Republicans generally say the Biden administration focused too much on its own priorities instead of its congressionally mandated ones. So priorities like student debt relief. The Biden administration says Congress paid for the, you know, they mandated this, but they never paid for it. So they didn't have the resources to pull it off. Our findings suggest the truth is somewhere in the middle of that. And really that the project just seems to have flown under the radar. It was a systems project. It was, you know, overseen primarily by career staff, we've been told. It was contracted out. Like, it was just something that was supposed to work. And I think from what we were told, that was the underlying assumption, was that it was just going to work. And the FAFSA never really became a massive priority, you know, on all levels of the government, because Congress really didn't start having, you know, scrutinizing the project until the FAFSA launch, like, didn't happen. So it wasn't like Congress has been asking for updates every month since they passed their law. Like, they also kind of didn't talk about it. And so it just flew under the radar until it was a crisis. And at that point, it was unclear if the department was going to be able to right the ship in time. So lots of ideas, and I think in some ways this is just kind of how government projects work nowadays in a divided Congress and government.
So there's a long history of major technology projects not going well. What is different now is, or exaggerated or exacerbated now, is the politicization around it. Any screw up by an administration today is going to get excoriated by Congress, but this is a big one, especially because of the impact on people, right? I mean, this is one of the most important jobs that the education department has. And how persuaded were you and Liam by the arguments that the department's focus on sort of other things? This has been a very ambitious administration in a bunch of ways, and it's clear that its top priority has been debt relief. And I guess I'm curious sort of about the interaction between those two things in particular. Did you come away feeling like that was a legitimate gripe, even in a politicized environment?
Yeah. So I would note up top, there's a lot we don't know about kind of the decision-making that went on to this. I mean, there's constant kind of question on, like, were staff pulled off, you know, working on FAFSA to work on debt relief. At this point, we don't know. This is the subject of two GAO investigations. There will be hearings in Congress. So, like, more to come on the specifics. But I think, yeah, the administration had their priorities and they wanted to get a lot done. I mean, you can look at everything they've done regulatory and, you know, on the student loan side. I mean, the way people have suggested to me, it's basically what Obama did in 8, the Biden administration did in 4. So they've taken on a lot. They had to rebuild the department from the Trump era. They had the pandemic. So like, I'm persuaded that they had a lot going on and that they were given a tight timeline to turn around this project. I think to the extent of like, did debt relief distract from FAFSA is still unclear to me. But I think, as we said in the story, like the project was not a top priority. And I can say that because I've been asking for more details on the project since I got here. And the way that the administration responds when you ask about debt relief and when you ask about FAFSA, they're just different. They're like staffed out different people. It's just a different thing. One is a White House priority and one is like a contracted, like mandated priority from Congress. I think they were just treated differently.
I think it's, you're absolutely right, Catherine. I think the other factor that's sort of in the back of my mind as somebody who has sat through any number of speeches and hearings and presentations from Lamar Alexander with his stack of paper, you make this great point that there was no champion. And without Lamar Alexander in the Senate anymore, you have to imagine it would be a different world because this was such his pet project for so long that were he still in office, you have to imagine there would be a different approach to accountability, at least publicly, than there seems to have been. I don't know that the FAFSA project really had a congressional champion who was holding the department and the administration accountable for meeting this deadline, having sufficient time for testing, all of the things that from a project management standpoint seem to have been missed.
I think that's in one way is where debt relief just did. I mean, we've seen this since the start of the administration. I mean, debt relief has sucked up so much energy, especially after Biden's announcement in August 2022 that he was going to forgive, you know, up to $20,000. And that was like the broad-based loan forgiveness. I mean, it went debt relief and then it went restarting payments. It was just sucked up so much time and energy from everyone, even on the Hill. Because I remember being at a hearing like May 2023. The department had recently announced the FAFSA was going to be delayed. I've been on the FAFSA reporter. Like, I'm the FAFSA reporter. I'm like, this is great. They are going to talk about this at the hearing when Rich Cordway and James Quall come to speak on the Hill. And there was one question, like there was like one kind of like series of questions about the FAFSA then. And maybe May 2023 would have been a good time to press these officials on their plans for it and to kind of hold their feet to the fire a little bit publicly.
Just the flip side of the administration being overly focused on debt relief, arguably, so were probably the critics in certain ways. In other words, congressional Republicans who might have been focused on asking those questions back in that May hearing, I'm guessing most of the questions were around debt relief and why the administration shouldn't be doing what it was doing or whatever. So that issue, it was a equal opportunity focus on debt relief. Do you think that the FAFSA mess has had any impact on perceptions of higher education, or is it pretty much being focused on government performance?
My sense is that it's mostly focused on the federal government. I think there are a lot of institutions that have leapt to be as creative as possible and to do as much as possible to mitigate the impact of this on families. My biggest concern is that we are on the heels of COVID, where I think you can argue that we have lost a large portion of a generation of students, that we are seeing yet another major loss of students. I just continue to look at the stories about students in mixed status families who still are unable to fill the FAFSA out. And the response and the solution is to do it on paper. What world are we living in here in 2024 where our best solution is please fill this out on paper? So I'm hopeful that institutions are getting credit for being creative. But I am sure there are some institutions out there who are either unable or unwilling to move to a more creative approach to packaging students that are probably going to not necessarily be seen in a favorable light. It boggles my mind that not every institution in the entire country has said, forget May 1, we're going for June 1. I would love to sit in a room and hear the conversation about why we're not going to be flexible and move that date.
I wanted to just chat a little bit about the other thing. About 10 days ago, we published our annual survey of presidents, and usual fodder for sort of fascinating insight into the brains of college presidents and the hearts to some extent of college presidents, although we can talk a little bit about whether we think we're getting honest responses, because I heard you talk about that a little bit on your own podcast. But, for those of you who haven't seen the survey, you covered a wide range of topics. The clearest sort of takeaway is that a lot of college presidents feel their own institutions are in pretty good shape and the rest of higher education, not so much. And that's been true in certain realms for a long time, like around the status of race, the racial climate and other things. But we saw it sort of spread to other topics this year. So I'm curious, just, you know, love to hear a couple of takeaways from you about the survey, what you think, what it leaves you thinking about sort of the state of leadership and of the state of higher education.
I would love to sit down and do some focus groups with you with respondents. And I also have a pending request for some cross tabs, because I really want to dig into where the data is. But as you mentioned, I co-host a podcast called Trusted Voices with Teresa Valerio Parrott. And we spent a lot of time unpacking the results. I think our biggest surprise continues to be around that contrast that you pulled out. And in fact, I went back and pulled your headlines from the last couple years of survey results. And it is a really consistent trend that presidents are super optimistic and comfortable with where their own institutions are and are very worried about everybody else. And it leaves me wondering, is this presidents feeling like their job is to be optimistic and to be a cheerleader for their institution, and so they have to put this forward? Is it sort of a self-protection thing where I'm really worried about this, but I'm not going to let them see me sweat? That's sort of why I would love to sit down with some of these folks. You know, if we could identify people who said, I'm fabulous, everything else is going to hell in a handbasket, and dig in and say, like, what's the thought process there? I was also really interested in the data point around, you know, about a third of presidents saying to talented colleagues, this is not a job you want to go for anymore. This is too hard. This is too stressful. This is nearly an undoable job, which is a question that I've been asking a lot. And that's really where I would love to see a breakout of how those responses fall between women and men and between presidents of color and white presidents, because I am guessing, you know, just from what I've observed, we've all observed, that I wouldn't be surprised to see women of color saying this too much. And a lot of the conversations that I know Rachel Tour has been having with folks who she talks to for The Sandbox bear that out, that this is a really difficult job for everybody right now, but certainly for women of color, this has become nearly undoable, not because of a lack of skills, but because of just all of these pressures, personal, professional, and otherwise.
Well, and a little bit of a tidbit that I haven't actually gotten into print yet. I did a story a couple of years ago about the change in hiring practices before and after the murder of George Floyd, and which found that there had been a not insignificant increase in the number of institutions hiring people of color and women into presidencies. And one of the big questions then was, so yes, institutions are doing more hiring of these groups of people. Will they support them and will they thrive? There is a higher rate of attrition for Black presidents, higher still for Black women. So it sort of bears out kind of the perception that you have. I'm hoping to get that published soon.
Thank you for breaking news here. But it can't be surprising, right? Anybody who's read about the glass cliff, institutions, small I institutions, tend to turn to women and people of color when we're in the shit, to be real frank about it, when we are at a moment of crisis. And, you know, it's unfair. I go back to the American College President Survey from ACE that came out last spring, 2023, where they asked presidents, do you feel you got an accurate assessment of the financial position and the strength of your institution from the board when you were interviewing? And, you know, the number was horrifying enough of it in and of itself. But you look at the respondents who are people of color, men and women of color, and see that 10% more say, I didn't get an accurate picture of what I was walking into from the board that hired me. There's something there.
That concludes today's conversation with Aaron Hennessy of TVP Communications and Catherine Knott of Inside Higher Ed. Thanks to both of them for their time and their insights. We covered a lot of ground today, and we probably could have spent a whole episode on any one of the topics we talked about. Those topics, college athlete unionization, the federal government's FAFSA fiasco, and the perceptions of college presidents about their roles and their institutions, seem disparate, but I saw some connections between them in our conversation. First, the federal government plays a role in all of them. That's most obvious when it comes to the financial aid snafu. But a federal agency allowed Dartmouth basketball players to unionize, and Congress considers it within its seemingly ever-expanding purview to look into the issue. And when we talk about how hard it is to be a college president these days, part of the reason is because of the scrutiny governments are increasingly applying to higher education, much of it perfectly understandable and warranted, but certainly some of it deeply political and even personal. I think we'll only see the federal involvement in higher education increase going forward. The other feeling I had about this conversation is one of empathy for the people who are trying to lead colleges and universities right now. There are so many things that a college and its leaders can stumble over right now from so many different directions, and I'm certainly sensing that higher ed leaders are feeling beleaguered and besieged. I know reading Inside Higher Ed, and maybe even listening to a podcast like this, can reinforce those feelings, but that's obviously not our goal. Our goal is to help those of you who care about higher education to understand what's coming at you, with the hope that that understanding can help you and your colleagues figure out how to anticipate and respond when the next set of challenges come your way. Please shout if you have ideas for topics we should explore that might help you do that. That's all for this episode of The Key. I'm Doug Letterman, and until next time, stay well and stay safe.